Have you ever faced something so shattering, a sudden crash or a devastating loss? A moment where the ground literally disappears beneath you and wondered how you could ever possibly come back. Our guest today knows that feeling intimately. We're talking about trauma, not just as a concept, but as a real force that can break us and incredibly make us. Today, we're sitting down with Jeff Rasley, if I'm saying it correctly, an author, a Himalayan expedition leader, and a dedicated humanitarian. Jeff is a survivor who navigated intense PTSD following a crippling motorcycle wreck in Mexico and a fatal avalanche in Nepal. His journey isn't about surviving those high-stake moments. It's about what he learned on the other side. This conversation is for anyone who's ever felt broken and needs a guide on finding their way back to purpose. So we're going to dive right in. This is Keeping It Real on Purpose, and I am Edna White, your host. And I welcome my guest, Jeff Rasley, to the show.
Thank you, Edna. It's very good to be with you.
Yeah, you too. So I'm really excited because when I was reading your bio, I was like, man, I gotta see what this guy looks like.
Well, sorry to disappoint you on that score.
All of this, I have to, oh man, I gotta see this guy because he's got some strength and some angels around him, and just really defying the odds. That's the word, defying the odds. So tell us about, how you show up in the world, because I know some of it, but the audience doesn't know.
Well, currently, I'm a writer. I've published 17 books, I think about 90 articles. So that's sort of my primary focus now. I practiced law for 30 years. Then I taught a class on philanthropy at Marion University and Butler University here in Indianapolis, where I live. And I've been married to the same woman for 50 years,
Wow.
Alicia.
Congratulations.
We were college sweethearts at the University of Chicago, and we have two grown kids. And I have a poppy cat who's wandering around
Yeah, I
and
see
who
her
every now
tail.
and then sticks her tail where the camera can see her.
That's wonderful. Jeff, your life has included two life-altering events, the motorcycle wreck in Mexico and the avalanche in Nepal. Most people can't even imagine that level of crisis. In this immediate aftermath of either of those crises, what was the first thought or feeling that signaled this was more than just a bad day?
Well, yeah, so I was 19 when I was on a motorcycle with a passenger on the back who I had actually just met that day down in Mazatlan, Mexico. And we were riding into town from a camp. We came to a cross street. I looked both ways, started to cross, and then there was just an explosion, and I went flying through the air. And we had been T-boned by a car. I flew over the handlebars, landed on all fours, sort of cat-like. And my only injuries were I cracked my radius forearm and broke my shoulder. But my passenger, wonderful guy named Bob Dell, who had taken my buddy, Tim Kosnov, who he and I had ridden over 4,000 miles together from Indiana down through Mexico. But Bob and his friend Gene took us in. Were kind of looking out for us because Tim's motorcycle was stolen that day. So within a matter of hours, my riding partner's motorcycle was stolen with everything, his pack, all of his clothes, his money. And then I was hit and my motorcycle was wrecked. And Bob was really very seriously injured. And we were taken to a hospital. But you asked what was my immediate reaction. Mm-hmm. So I was in shock. I mean, medical, a state of shock. But I saw Bob in the street with bones sticking out from his shoulder and his hip. And I just started yelling for an ambulance, you know, get an ambulance, and which eventually an ambulance came and we were taken to a hospital.
Right. That's tough. That's really tough. There's a lot of like, I know I've been in a car accident and, you know, and I didn't even think about PTSD from after it. But I know that there's an amount of PTSD that you experienced. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, it took quite a while because I was in survival mode for some time because after the crash, Bob and I were in the hospital and we were under arrest. There was an armed guard sitting at the at our doorway into the hospital room 24 hours a day.
Wow.
And Bob came out of emergency surgery and was crying and moaning and was obviously in terrible pain. And I kept asking the guard to go get a doctor because my friend needed, you know, help, needed to be looked at. Because he was in so much pain, and the guard, the policeman, wouldn't let me, and he wouldn't do it. So eventually, I knocked him down and jumped over him and ran out and found a doctor, and they came back and gave Bob more Demerol to treat the pain.
Mm-hmm.
But then, you know, it was a complicated situation to get out of the hospital and get out of the country. But eventually we did. And then Tim and I hitchhiked home to Indiana from California.
How far? Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, 2,000 miles. So we were about 750 miles down in Mazatlan from the California border. And I had relatives, aunt and uncle and cousins in the L.A. area. So we took a train up there, but then we hitchhiked home because we were 19-year-olds. We were determined to get home on our own power. Not our own power, but heard your dog. So we hitchhiked home. And again, it was just like I'm in survival mode. This isn't really affecting me. And then after I was home, I was working in a factory before I went back to school at the University of Chicago. And I had a steel pin in my shoulder and my arm was in a cast and then a sling. And it was, you know, still just, you know, surviving that. And then it wasn't really until I was back in school, I started waking up every night completely covered in sweat, just total body sweat.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at first I didn't know what was going on. I mean, I had never experienced this before, but eventually I kept having, you know, kind of reliving the crash and seeing Bob with the bones sticking out of his hip and his shoulder. And we stayed in contact and wrote each other and talked on the phone. We eventually, over the years, lost contact. I don't know what's happened to him.
Right, right.
But he was crippled. I mean, he would be, you know, he was going to walk with a limp at best the rest of his life.
Wow.
And so even though the woman who hit us was eventually also arrested, and it was determined by the local prosecutor that it was her fault.
Right.
You know, I've felt this really terrible guilt that this was the first time Bob had ever been on a motorcycle.
Oh, wow.
And he asked me to give him a ride and take, you know, ride him into town. And then that happened. So it was, right. You know, for a 19-year-old, it was just hard to live with.
Yeah.
And that the sweats lasted for about 9 months, basically through the school year. And then that next summer, my wife and I got married. And I don't know if I should give her credit, but it seems like eventually over the course of that next year, I mean, they continued even after we were married for a while, but it became, you know, less and less often, more time would go. And so it was, you know, maybe once a week, and then eventually it stopped.
Wow. Wow. You experienced some significant PTSD from that. And I know maybe even Bob probably, right? So I know it seemed like the way you're telling me, it's like a relentless cycle. And even there was great joyous things happening, you still experience this. When was the time that you saw that small crack of light that you could start to kind of dig out of that survival mode?
Yeah, well, you know, when I was in the kind of the survival mode, it was all about just sort of, I can kind of equate it to doing trucking and mountaineering, where, you know, the physical challenge is so great that you just focus on your next step, you know, put that one foot in front of the other, and you keep going by taking the next step, next step. And I think that's sort of, you know, how I was living until the you know, kind of the night sweats and the nightmares sort of took me out of that. And I had to start confronting, you know, what had happened, as opposed to just focusing on that next step, and to be more introspective and just really look down deeply into not only what happened, but how I felt about it, how it affected Bob, and that I had to, you know, take some responsibility for that, and what happened to me. And, you know, eventually it was something like, okay, I can live with that. It happened. Yeah. There's nothing, I can't change it.
Right.
And so now I'm going to just go back to enjoying life.
Yeah, that's good. Did you ever incorporate writing or anything like that into that as you were going through survival mode, or no?
Well, actually, I wrote my BA paper, so 2.5 years later, about that experience. Advisor was very kind of flexible, liberal guy. And so I was supposed to write a paper about philosophy. And so what I did is I got permission to start a novel. And the novel was based on my motorcycle experience with my buddy, Tim. And so I called it a novel, but it was really a memoir.
Gotcha.
And I started writing about that entire experience. And so I did. I really, you know, relived it through writing it out.
Wow, that's good. That's good. Because I know a lot of our audience, they write, or they're interested in writing, or they're book readers. So it's so important to kind of see if that even helped. Because I know for me, coming out of my trauma, writing helped a lot. I mean, putting it down on paper and getting it out of you is so, you know, liberating. And it kind of frees you up to the next step, as you were saying, to the next step. What's the next thing? So that was really good, you know. So you've led expeditions to in the Himalayas, and you run a humanitarian work like the Bassa Village Foundation. You guide people through intense risk. How do you personally experience with the trauma that you had change your approach to leading other people?
Well, I started going to Nepal in 1995 and had done a couple mountaineering expeditions, but not as a leader. And on the third mountaineering expedition, mm-hmm. when we were trekking out from the mountain, so climbing experience was over, we're just trekking out to get back to Lukla Village, which is mm-hmm. high up in the mountains, and it's an airstrip, and we're going to fly back to Kathmandu. And there had been avalanches all the time that we were up in the mountains this time. And, but they'd been in the distance and wasn't really dangerous for us. And we were going across this high pass. It was 15,000 feet high, but, mm-hmm. Compared to a 22,000 foot high mountain, no big deal. We're just, getting through it. But the snow had gotten really, really deep, and it was thigh high as we were going across this pass. And what happens when there's a lot of snow, mm-hmm. if there was warm weather before that, which there was, then there's this sort of division. There's okay. the soft where it's warm, and the snow is piled up on top of that, and it can become dangerous because this snow up here can, because of that difference in the layer, can start falling it's off slow. On mm-hmm. a steep incline and turn into an avalanche. So that's exactly what happened. And above us, actually on a higher ridge, were three Nepali porters. And they weren't the porters from our group, but they were porters from another climbing team.
Okay.
And we heard this roar and immediately, knew the sound. This was an avalanche and it was up above us. And so there were four of us, our guide, and then our three climbers. And we just started running, or actually four climbers, so there were five of us. Mm-hmm. So we just started running down the incline, down the mountainside. And by the time the avalanche got to us, it was just what we call spin drift. It was just like you're inside a blizzard, mm-hmm. Just sleet and snow, but no boulders, no flying rocks, nothing that's really going to hurt you. So you can't really see because it's just so thick. But so we got down to the bottom of this mountainside, and the three porters that we had seen up above us before were just gone. We didn't know what happened to them, but we found out later that they had been killed. They were wiped out by the avalanche, and the avalanche separated us from our porters, who were carrying all of our heavy baggage, the tents and cooking supplies, all that kind mm-hmm. of stuff. We had just our own backpacks with our own gear. And so we're separated from them. The avalanche is blocked, so they can't get to us, we can't get to them. And our guide decided we should just go on to Lukla. So the five of us, the four climbers, four Westerners, and the guide, we had to cross three streams to get to Lukla, and each stream was getting higher and higher. So like the first one was ankle deep, mm-hmm. next one was knee deep, the next one was thigh deep. And but we made it to Lukla. We were soaked and freezing, but we were there, we were safe. And we were staying at a lodge, and so our guide went back to try to get to our porters, mm-hmm. And so he's gone. He said, you know, just stay here, get warm, get fed, you know, take care of yourself. So we're doing that. And the woman who runs the lodge, in Nepal, you call them Didi, which means big sister. Mm-hmm. So our Didi is looking out for us. And then she comes to us that evening and she's very upset. And what's happened is her brother was on a flight flying in from Kathmandu to Lukla and the plane crashed. And it turned out that everybody in that plane was killed, including mm-hmm. her brother. Wow. But at first, you know, we don't know what's happened to them. We don't know what's happened to our porters. So we wait all night long. And eventually, late in the next day, the good news is our guide, Seth, comes back with our porters. He had to carry one of them because he was had severe frostbite. But they made it back, brought all of the tents and all the gear with them. Mm-hmm. They were soaking wet because by the time they got to the river, it was neck high, and Seth had to create a rope yeah. bridge, and he had to go back and forth, and he was just amazing, yeah. courageous, strong guy.
Yeah. What lessons about fear do you now pass on to the leaders, though? Out of all that you've done now, what lesson do you about fear do you pass on to leaders?
Well, I would say perseverance, that, okay. you know, you just, if you're afraid of something, you just look it in the eye and face it down mm-hmm. and go on. And that, you know, that sort of back into the survival mode of right. next step, just take next that next step.
Yeah. You're now a prolific author. It seems you repurposed a lot of the pain and you transform a lot of the chaotic past into purposeful communication after writing all those books and all those papers. For listeners who are currently struggling through their own wreckage right now, what's the most crucial step you took successfully to find meaning or purpose after those disasters?
Well, it took a long time, I suppose, to reach this understanding, but eventually it occurred to me that living your life is like creating a work of art.
Oh, that's nice.
And so every day you are adding to that work of art. Yeah. And as an artist, you want to make it beautiful.
Right.
And so the banner on my website is live your life like it's a work of art and make it beautiful.
That's very nice.
Thank you. Yes. I mean, that's sort of the fundamental philosophy Absolutely. That I try to live by.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I like that. Are you working on anything right now?
Yeah, I'm actually working on two projects. One is with my wife. Mm-hmm. We during COVID, we started visiting small towns all over Indiana, and we've been okay. to over 250 of
wow.
them.
Wow.
And we research each town, take photographs, do a post in Facebook about each town, but we're compiling it very slowly into a book. That's about beautiful. Small town Indiana. Mm. And then I'm writing an autofiction book, meaning a novel based on a real experience, which is I was a law clerk for a guy my senior year in law school who was the hottest criminal defense attorney in the Midwest. And he handled a number of high profile criminal cases. And it was fascinating to work for him, but it's also a tragic story because he went from being this, you know, high profile guy. He was written up in Playboy magazine and, you know, wow. things like that
yeah.
to getting involved in cocaine, ended up losing his law license, going bankrupt and fleeing the country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a kind of the rise and fall story based on him, but it's fictionalized.
Okay. Yeah, you know, they say a little fiction is always a little nonfiction in there. Just a little bit.
Yeah. and nowadays, can we tell the difference between?
Right. I don't think so. Right. That's right. Listen, Jeff, we've been talking with you, your incredible story, and I want to thank you for that, turning tragedy into transformation. What you share with us today is resilience. Isn't something that you're born with. It's something you build in the aftermath of being broken. And I like that. I like that your story, and I know your journey will prove special to those in the audience. Even to end their own trauma and to see it in a different light, like you said, take your life and create it like it's a work of art, you know, and that's a great lesson all in itself. Is there one thing that you could tell our audience who is struggling right now with trauma or feel broken, and what you could tell them? One last thing.
Okay. Yeah. You will live through it. You will live through it. You just take that next step create your life like it is a work of art, because it can be beautiful.
Awesome. That's right. So go find Jeff's 17 books and his incredible humanitarian work with Bassa Village Foundation. I believe you could just find him by just writing his name. Google him, Jeff Rasley. All right, audience, we want to thank you for being here today, hearing this incredible story. And I know that there's more to come when we talk about Jeff Rasley. Bye for now.